There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com. Eye on Health on Dubai Today with Sally Moussa on DubaiEye 103.8.
Good afternoon, this is Emma Brain sitting in for Sally Moussa. It's today's Eye on Health, and in this first hour we are talking to Dr. Yasser Nakhlawi, consultant in paediatrics and director of clinical affairs at Al Zahra Hospital in Dubai. Good afternoon, doctor. How are you?
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. And today we're talking about sepsis, something that I was quite shocked when I pulled up some statistics on this. Sepsis is the primary cause of death from infection across the world, with up to 30 million people affected. But what is it? How do we spot it? And how do we then treat it in children? And apparently in developing countries, it's responsible for 60 to 80% of child deaths. So, doctor, first off, what is sepsis for those of us that don't know?
First, thank you for addressing this very important issue, and it's really crucial for people to understand what is sepsis. Sepsis is a broad term of bacterial infection of the body. And we start with like a bacterial invasion, either from airborne or through skin or through the GI tract. Somehow the bacteria reach the blood, and that's called bacteremia. And when the bacteria becomes in a large amount and able to introduce toxins to the body, and this is what we call septicemia or sepsis, the bacteria can settle somewhere. For example, if it settles in the lung, that's what we call pneumonia, or in the ear, causing otitis media, or in the brain and meninges, which is called meningitis, or it become overwhelming to the body and affect different body system, which can cause like almost shutdown of the body. So, as I said, it's a broad term, and it can come in so many ways with different presentations.
And as we said, it's caused by bacteria. It's a bacterial infection. And obviously, it must be difficult to diagnose this in children particularly. What would a parent have to look out for? And how would you, as a doctor, what would your protocols then be? What would your advice be for parents? Because I'm assuming with little ones, with tiny babies and children, they could get a cold or a fever. What are the symptoms of sepsis that parents should look out for?
That's a very good question, very good point to bring up. In children, it's the most challenging to diagnose sepsis because sometimes, like very young ones, they cannot talk or recite their pains, or so the presentation could be very subtle. And like change in behavior, feeding pattern, or drowsiness, excessive sleeping, fever, of course, is the most presenting presentation of sepsis or infection in general. But let's go back and just divide the pediatric population, children population, into age groups. Mm-hmm. So let's start with the premature babies. Premature babies, almost their immune system does not exist, and it's very hard to fight bacteria. And we kind of do what's called presume sepsis or rule out sepsis. And when we teach our junior residents and young doctors, we kind of tell them top three diagnoses of a child premature with fever. And the top three diagnoses are sepsis, sepsis, sepsis.
Okay.
So it has to be, you know, presumed as the first thing, because this is the worst can happen. So when we have a premature baby, we do the workup. We start with antibiotics because we know that they are very vulnerable and chances are very high. And if we haven't caught sepsis early on, can lead to deleterious complication down the road.
So with the premature babies, it's better to assume the worst and then move backwards from that?
That is absolutely true. Then to the next age group, like from 0 to 2 months, any fever above, I would say 38.4, is an alarming sign. Nevertheless, sometimes those babies can present with poor feeding or drowsiness or change in behavior, which still could be, you know, a sign or of sepsis. And those ones, still, we do what's called full sepsis workup for them, which includes spinal tap to check for the cerebrospinal fluid, make sure there's no meningitis, getting a blood culture and a blood count to make sure there's no bacteria in the blood, check the urine, make sure there's no urinary tract infection, look at the blood counts, look at the number of the white cells, the differentiation of the white cells, which kind of give idea about, you know, the status of if this baby having bacterial infection. Look at the inflammatory parameters. We do something called CRP or procalcitonin, which are a kind of directors into the direction of, like, if there's, like, you know, there's a big inflammation, bacterial infection. So there's no single test we do that can tell us we're early on whether there's a sepsis or not. There's something called workup.
Right.
And, of course, the clinical presentation of the child, which we should never be deceived with a baby with high fever and looking great. But still, we have to do what we have to do to make sure this is just, not a start of a sepsis or serious infection. Then we start the baby on antibiotic early on, then we, because the cultures come back in like 48 to 72 hours. So we should not be waiting around without, you know, full coverage of the child with suspected bacteria. So we use appropriate antibiotic and appropriate doses, and everything is based on weight and the clinical suspicion of the physician. So for older children, we have a little bit of room to negotiate, kind of thing. Like, you know, above 2 months, we don't have to do spinal tap for every baby. Sometime if the baby looks fine, no meningitic signs, they can tell us more, or we can find more symptoms that can direct us to the issue right away. Of course, the older the child gets, it's easier.
Sure.
To make a diagnosis. But the most challenging part when they're tiny, and they're small, less than 2 months, and premature babies.
So on average, how many cases might you see on a yearly basis in your job?
Well, it depends on the season and where you practice. Like if you practice in the tertiary care center, you're probably going to see more than when you see in, like, you know, primary care setting. But everybody, all physicians have to be aware of this, because basically those sick babies can show up anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So the statistic you're telling me is very true. I mean, it's common, and the level of suspicion have to be very high.
Okay. When we come back very shortly, we'll talk about other ways to prevent sepsis or reduce the risks of it, treatments and vaccinating your children. Can that help prevent sepsis infections?
Dubai Today.
Good afternoon. This is Emma Brain in for Sally Musa this afternoon, and we are talking sepsis in this hour. Dr. Yasser Nakhlawi, consultant in paediatrics and director of clinical affairs in Al Zahra Hospital in Dubai. Just pulling out some facts for you. And apparently the incidence of sepsis is increasing dramatically due to the aging population, and despite advantages of modern medicine, including vaccines, antibiotics and intensive care units, hospitalisation for sepsis have more than doubled over the last 10 years and have overtaken those for myocardial infarction in the US. So some quite worrying statistics there, Doctor. So what can we do to help reduce the incidence of sepsis occurring in the first place? Is there anything that we can do?
Well, definitely prevention is better than treatment, as they say. So first, recognition sepsis in its early stages is very important. It's easier to treat. So making an awareness program like this one is really crucial. And community mass education is very important. Now, the vaccinations are very important because now we there are certain bacteria we don't see anymore, like Haemophilus influenza type B. We've been vaccinating for Haemophilus for a long time, and it used to be causing very aggressive meningitis and sepsis and wound infection and so on. We don't see it anymore. Another certain bacteria which are vaccinating for, which is a pneumococcus. So we give a vaccine called Prevnar or PSV vaccine. This bacteria used to cause a lot of sepsis, pneumonia, ear infection, and we're seeing less of that due to vaccination. So vaccination are really important, not only bacteria like for polio, measles, other infections. They're really receding. You don't see many on in the communities where vaccination rates are high. So indeed, vaccinating children is a way to prevent very serious infections. Vaccination, basically, certain vaccines are giving at birth, then the primary series, which you're giving the first year, and the second year, and the preschool boosters are definitely important to reduce incidence of sepsis due to this aggressive bacteria.
And we kind of end up, I think, is it the herd concept? Is that you got the hurdle? I've forgotten the term. The herd mentality, basically, where you vaccinate loads of children so it prevents the spread of obviously diseases and illnesses and all the rest of it. So are there instances in certain communities where children aren't being vaccinated that we're seeing rises in these problems?
Yes, actually there are several examples of breakthroughs of all diseases that we haven't seen for a long time. Very good example of that is measles. Measles vaccine, which is called MMR, giving in the first year, booster, second year, another booster at 4 years. There was a lot of rumors about the association of measles and autism, for example. There's about one article came from France in the late 90s, and this article was discredited strongly, and several articles came back and disproved the association of measles with autism. It just happened. Autism is diagnosed in the early second year, and the first measles giving at age of one, so it's a kind of time association, but the evidence-based medicine proven against that. That is absolutely no association between MMR and autism. In certain countries where people were scared of giving MMR, we've seen a lot of measles outbreaks and full measles presentation with the complications and everything. So, yes, absolutely. Communities who have high rate of vaccination, certain diseases are receding back, and we don't see it anymore. Good example of that is poliomyelitis. Poliomyelitis almost got eradicated from the world, except in some countries who are does not have the best vaccination program. You still have cases reported, but for example, smallpox. Mm-hmm. Very good example of an illness that is used to cause a lot of morbidity and mortality, and we don't see it anymore because of the vaccination and so on. So definitely vaccination is a crucial thing to do for your child.
And that kind of leads on to my next question. Obviously, with infections like sepsis, the go-to treatment is antibiotics. If there's an increase in problems that are caused by bacterial infections that require antibiotics, does giving antibiotics at children at these very, very young ages increase the risk of becoming resistant to antibiotics, and that they're not working as well later on in life? Are there any problems with becoming resistant to these treatments?
Well, definitely antibiotics are it's a bi-bladed sword, as they say. They can be a life-saving if it's used properly. And yes, they can lead to antibiotic resistance if they were used an inappropriate way. So what is the appropriate way of using antibiotics? Using antibiotics, the bacterial infection have to be documented or highly suspicious. So proper course of antibiotic have to be given. Using antibiotic for 2 days and the child gets better, then stopping the antibiotics is really a good recipe for resistance. Because what happens, they kill maybe 90% of the bacteria and they leave 10% left, which not enough to cause serious illness. And those, those 10% of the bacteria become resistant. Okay, so next time you use antibiotic, then you're dealing with bacteria that were developed already resistant to this antibiotic. That's how, right. Resistance developed. Of course, using antibiotics for viral infection or cold or things are not appropriate. And most of the time, some patients go to the pharmacy and ask for antibiotic, which is really, you get the inappropriate antibiotic for what you have, even if the child is having ear infection and recurrent ear infection. So with ear infection, for example, when we have the first ear infection, we use something light, this is really not strong. But if we have a child who's proven resistant and recurrent of antibiotic, we kind of shift to a different groups or different combinations that we know this is going to, handle this infection properly. So actually, let me give you a good example. When we used to do research, a good way of developing resistance to antibiotic is of bacteria is using an old antibiotic.
Right.
So what happens if somebody gets an antibiotic for ear infection and you have some left and you put it in the fridge, okay? So after like 10 days, basically, the antibiotic loses its potency and so on until it becomes like, enough to just give resistant bacteria. So that's how we used to do it in the lab. So don't use it at home. I mean, don't keep antibiotic in the fridge just in case. Or I get always like a question, well, we're traveling. Can you write us antibiotic because we're traveling? I said, well, how can I predict which infection you're going to get?
Yeah.
Or like, the storage condition of the antibiotic, which, is going to be worse than not giving antibiotic if you give an old antibiotic that's already lose its potency.
Okay. And as always, if there's any problems, go and see your doctor. Just don't get something over the counter. Thank you very much, Dr. Yasser Nakhlaoui.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.